course, one has to point out that bells are, in fact, simply upside-down pots. And one of the books that Paolo read a long time ago and is still on his bookshelf is Mumford, the City in History. And in the opening paragraph, he talks about the city as a container. The city is a pot. And, of course, Paolo's cities are containers. They are pots. There is, of course, also the great importance of Cusanti as not just a workshop of building techniques, but as a place where ideas have bore fruit. The handcraft processes, the casual, intimate, personal kind of experience on these 5 acres perhaps anticipate the richness of intimate and personal experience that one would ultimately experience in these almost megalomaniac structures of giant arcologies. Paolo put together some ideas that he'd had earlier and put together a sketchbook called The Cosmic Potentials.
Well, being in a sunny country and being very having a propensity for the outdoor may be a thing that the sun should be used even more than what I was using it. And naturally, when you think of the sun, then you automatically think of the wind and the water and the tides and the moon and the energy that's available. So I began to try to think what would happen if you could come up with structures shaped in such a way as to be able to capture those energies.
One of these sketches, 1950, it's a building that's shaped something like a catcher's mitt, which would face the sun. Balconies then would catch the sun's energy and transform it into something usable. This one would use the potential of wind and would collect the wind on the surfaces.
Another design consisted of a huge, slowly rotating metal rod, heated on one side by the sun and cooled on the other side by a stream of cold water. The expansion contraction of the rod would be translated into useful energy.
After 2 years of being in that and being through one of the symposium on solar energy in Phoenix, I decided that the time wasn't right, or I was after something that for the moment would not be successful anyhow. So my interest slackened. And at that moment, I began to be interested in the urban problem. But those structures were somehow, more than the bridges, were the beginning of the ecology concept.
In the meantime, Paolo was involved in the design and construction of a theater for the Indian School in Santa Fe, New Mexico. He quit the project before its completion. Jeffrey Cook describes the design of the theater.
Paolo had in mind several images, including the path of the sun, of the moon. He provided ramps and balconies and stairs and upper levels, a sort of Greek chorus-like general architectural scheme to encourage the liveliest application of imagination to a program which didn't really exist. I mean, Indian drama or theater does not occur in built structures. I think the liveliest and the most important idea in the Santa Fe Theater was this ramp, which stuck off the one side of the theater and ramped down to the stage level. And the idea was that you could run horses or cattle or buffalo down this ramp across and around the stage so that the action, which is such an important part of Indian ceremonial tradition, could become a part of the dynamic experience in this theater. The most important work of Paolo during the early and mid-60s was his work on a theoretical project called Mesa City for between 1 and 2 million people, which would be built on the top of a mesa in the southwest of the United States. The mesa would be something like 10 kilometers wide and 35 kilometers long. One of the elementary things is that Paolo designed the site, so therefore the site fits the plan very well.
Someone suggested one day that I should design a city. I think it was an art dealer. And the day after, I started designing a city.
What prompted him to make that suggestion?
Oh, seeing my designs, my work, and the fact that I was constantly somehow working around the idea of a community or a city, but there were scattered sketches or ideas. And at that point, I guess I was ready to concentrate in something more definite. So after doing some sketching, I applied for a grant. And I got it.
The plan in general is a kind of dumbbell shape, a lopsided dumbbell, in which the two nodes, one consists of university in this end, and the other end consists of a world center of religions. This drawing is of an artist's village. The drawing is over 100 feet long on butcher paper. And if you look carefully, you can see the little fingers here holding the thing up. This drawing was done, and it was never, ever seen all at once until this day that we held it up. Charles Eames was here taking pictures, and we took turns holding the thing up and then running around to see what the thing looked like. Some of the buildings start to develop into quite large forms. These are really villages. Which are about 300 stories high, which means that within themselves they are a kind of microcosm. When you get a building which is that high, even the natural climate at the bottom is very different from the natural climate at the top. But then if you consider the fact that the building has an open courtyard in the center, you begin to realize that you're developing a pretty heavy interior or semi-controlled microclimate. So that these buildings certainly approached archaeological possibilities in their size and in the possibility that the various parts of them would be designed comprehensively in an integrative way. The one criticism of Mesa City which has been published is one paragraph in Chris Alexander's pivotal essay of 1965 on modern city planning theory, which is called A City Is Not a Tree. And in that paragraph, he is critical of the Mesa City plan because he says it's just flat planning like every other 20th century city plan. He says that in spite of its organic appearances, its rich appearances, it is very two-dimensional. Nevertheless, Mesa City was very important in Paolo's self-growth. It gave the opportunity of assembling on an ideal basis the many components which we usually consider are necessary parts of a city, and it also gave him sites for a whole bunch of theoretical buildings in which he could explore in depth many of the architectural ideas which he was interested in at that time.
Turned out to be a flat, two-dimensional city, basically based on the logistics of the automobile, with some very peculiar or maybe exciting concept mixed in it, concept that became very common 15 or 20 years later. But one was the transformation of a scar into a garden, of a gravel pit or a quarry into a garden, into a park. The other one was the recycling through a systematic belt, through a belt where systematically you would have utilities and devices for recycling materials and refurbishing hardware and so on. Another was the beginning of the integrated systems, where you don't have only work or living or production or marketing or this or that, but you have all those things. One of the things was that there were two centers in the city. One was a cultural center, a learning center, and one was a theological center. So those were probably key elements for the future developments.
In a way, then, Mesa City was an arcology.
Well, yeah, it was a torn apart arcology.
So how did it come together?
Slowly, and with the realization that I wasn't as yet dealing with the core of the problem, which is far better logistics. No, I got a second grant to finish the material of Mississippi. Yeah, and when I got the second grant, somehow I got into it more intensely, and at that point I switched from Mississippi to our college. Some of the ideas which were part of Mississippi were already partial colleges, as far conceptually, because I had, for instance, villages which were one building, and in those villages there were many of the things that would be needed by a community, immediate needs, from the clinic to the market to the school to the church and so on, and they were all incorporated in this building, which was a village of about between 2,000 and 4,000 people, depending where they were. So those were already small or partial colleges, and then there were other structures like the learning center, which was definitely a three-dimensional volume.
What happened between there and the publication of City in the Image of Man?
Well, the work of some redefining the criteria of how to go about designing a city, and then trying to illustrate those criteria. So you decide that the city is going to be one building, and then you have to go on from there, try to illustrate this concept.
The book, Arcology, City in the Image of Man, was published in 1969 by MIT Press. The first part explained the theory of arcology, assuming that there are no problems of crime, discrimination, unemployment, etc. in our society. So Leary explains that it is still imperative to apply the concept of arcology, that is, miniaturizing the urban environment, in order to improve mutual access of the elements within the city. The second part of the book presents designs for possible arcologies.
At some point I went in some kind of a binge, where every 2 or 3 months I would come up with an idea. So in less than 2 years I had sketches for about 40 or 45 arcologies. But that means immediately that those were not blueprints, those were fantasies. But fantasies based on a certain logic. So as a phase of a certain process of going from the theoretical into the real, I think it was important, very important.
So people should look at them as
fantasies about a concept, around a concept, which is the concept of the complex, the miniaturized, the integrated, the three-dimensional. I began to think that the next step would have to be a demonstration. So I couldn't begin to think then that I would be able to begin a demonstration, but I started to work around the idea of a small arcology, and that became the last design in the book. But at that point, I began to really think seriously about it could be and how we could go about doing it. So I designed that with in mind a certain specific landscape in Arizona.
Beginning as early as the winter of 61-62, Paolo realized and was trying to make plans for leaving Doubletree Road and going to a larger site. He was aware that the ranch-style houses were coming down Doubletree Road. He knew that Paradise Valley was filling up, and he was anxious to have a larger piece of land in which there could be a more complete control of a larger environment, in which there could be a community of like spirits, of other people involved in arts and crafts, who could live in a more exemplary fashion. And so he began a search in which, on successive weekends, there would be expeditions, one-day and two-day expeditions, to various parts of rural Arizona. I went on a lot of those expeditions with him, and as did the whole family, and we usually had a very good time hiking around. It was very good from many points of view because, first of all, we saw Arizona firsthand. We appreciated the desert, and more particularly we came to understand what the desert meant, the delicacy in which these thorny and fortified plants survive, their slow rate of growth, their visual transparency, their vulnerability only to man. They're not vulnerable to the extremes of climate or to the lack of moisture. But man is their most horrific predator. And we came to understand the delicacy and the balance of this beautiful natural landscape under these harsh conditions. We came to understand this very thin skin of vegetation, which Paolo has written and talked about, which is the frail basis of all of human life.
Well, I looked for about 8 years. I was scouting very regularly and very haphazardly land on a radius of about 100 miles from Phoenix. And then after a few years of that, I began to concentrate in the areas between Prescott and Phoenix, or around Cortez Junction. Yeah. And then after an attempt to get some land further north, for which I designed the first layout, which was somehow a layout done at the Mesa City time, I got hold of this land. I got interested in this land. I bought some land on the opposite side, 60 acres, and then we decided we would buy it on 60 acres.
Arcosanti, the word is a contraction of arcology and cosanti, is a proto-arcology for 3,000 people that Solieri started to build on this land in 1969. The work is done by volunteers who come for 6 weeks and contribute about $300 towards the cost of materials, equipment, and food. Solieri is able to match this amount from the proceeds of the sale of his bells, books, and fees from his lectures. I asked Solieri what he has learned in the process of building Arcosanti.
Stuff. The main thing is that evidently the theoretical, it's important, but it's only the first step from the theoretical to the actual. There's an enormous amount of work to do, and you can fail in any step in trying to move from the theoretical to the practical. And the other thing is that yet I find out that yet what I think is necessary is to combine the long-term planning with the existential transformism of the process, which means though you maintain a certain scheme almost unchanged as a concept, you have to keep adapting this scheme to the contingency of the moment, which is not just landscape or people or this or that, it's everything. Availability of materials, availability of cash to buy the material, credit, how much you feel you can, how much power you feel you might have now and then, the climate, the weather within the climate, the people working with you, how many, how few, the scheduling, the influences of the environment in terms of people, building codes and zoning and.
So this is a practical demonstration of the thing that you talk about, that it's not possible to predict the future with a living process.
Well, in a way, I'm the least apt to predict the future in scientific terms. One reason is also because I don't have the means, but if I was more interested in it, I probably would find the means. But I've been involved somehow in empirical processes for a long time, through, for instance, the building of Cosanti. So it comes more natural for me to go about empirically. So that's why it's good that people are needling me about the fact that we should plan. But I'm the first one to say we should plan, because an ecology has to be planned. So we have to find the optimum where planning might become more systematic. At the same time, the direction, the construction keeps being geared to the imminence of the process, to the present, to the fact that the process is in a way as important as the end, as the goal.
You find that as the project is growing, it's getting a life of its own.
I hope so. I think it's beginning. For one thing, the violence of the sentiment surrounding it. Another one is that I begin to feel that the structure, the geological structure and the climate is working pretty well with what we're building.
What are you talking about, the violence? What do you mean by that, the violence surrounding it?
Well, the emotional attitude
of the people here,
and also outside. I don't think there is indifference. I think there is pro and con, and very much for, very much against, and so on.
I asked Suleri why it is imperative that we apply the principle of miniaturization complexification to the urban environment.
As Taylor Aldershot then says, we are part of a process, of a genesis. And this genesis, one of the main characteristics of this genesis is that you always move from the simple into the complex, relatively so. The successful next step is always more complex than the preceding step. So that was the key element that I sort of picked up. And I picked it up before I found out about Chardin, because their colleges were already in the making. But that gave confirmed to me that I was on the right track. The next step was for me to connect the concept to a physical dimension. So that's where miniaturization came. How is complexity possible? Through the process of implosion. Implosion of, not necessarily of matter, but implosion of consciousness or activities or information and so on. So wherever you have complexity, you can sure you're going to find out miniaturization. If you apply that to the whole of what we know concerning life, then you see that seems to be confirmed. And it seems to be confirmed by not just minute or uncertain terms, but in terms which are substantial in space and time. Time being over 3 billions of years, space being the space of the Earth.
Taillade de Chardin talks about an omega point as the final goal of consciousness. What is this omega point?
It was really the extrapolation of this idea of complexity and miniaturization that convinced me that by necessity, at the end of the process, you would have an omega point. And this omega point would be the totality of consciousness and control and power and presence. So that point, it's the closest thing to the concept of God that we in the Western world can come up with, I think.
During the early 60s, there was a movement among theologians declaring God is dead.
God is dead in the sense that it never existed, but never existed as a final, as a accomplished entity. It had always existed as an attempt or as a hypothesis or as a partial realization. So we can say that each present has its own immanent God. But the Godfather is dead for me, yes. It's the Alpha-God. It's that kind of original trust or consciousness or will that can be found in brute matter. And since brute matter seems to be somehow segregational in the sense of not being able to understand itself through its own particles, at least in a way that we understand understanding, it's easy to see that this God, instead of being one God, is an infinite number of godlets. So you have a polytheistic condition, a fragmented universe, the granular universe, for which each isolated particle can be seen as an expression, as the most primeval expression of some kind of an essence, and you can call that an essence a god. And from there on, it's the reduction of the number of those gods through the introduction of consciousness up to the point where this consciousness becomes one.
And that is the omega god?
Yeah, the monotheistic finality.
To end this program, I will read a short segment from Paolo's book, The Bridge Between Matter and Spirit, Is Matter Becoming Spirit?, which was published in 1973 as a Doubleday Anchor original. We are, at most, the first groping dendrils wedging themselves in the dark granularity of spirit's underpinnings. The future is literally the whole of life's evolution in time, space, power, but mainly in intensity. How else can we, life, create God? Arcosanti is located 1 mile northeast of Cordes Junction, which is 60 miles north of Phoenix on Interstate 17 at the Prescott turnoff. Except during the winter months, the site is open to visitors. Tours are given at 11 a.m. and 2 p.m. Cosanti is located in Scottsdale and is open to visitors who may buy metal and ceramic bells there. For information about Cosanti workshops, write to the Cosanti Foundation. That's COSANTI. Cosanti, 6433 Doubletree Road, Scottsdale, Arizona, 85253. Let me repeat the address. Cosanti Foundation, 6433 Doubletree Road, Scottsdale, Arizona, 85253. This program was produced and narrated by Frank Kroger at Pacifica Station KPFK in Los Angeles, with technical assistance from Peter Suttheim and Phil Mendelson.